Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour. Thank you for listening in, and I hope you're keeping warm in this wintry weather. Wind chill can go as low as minus 10 today and tonight, and snow is pretty much expected all day today with an accumulation of 4 to 8 inches possible. We're in a swath of cold precipitation that reaches across Central Iowa. I saw it on TV last night. It looks kind of like a big lozenge covering our area. And for some reason it was green, which didn't seem to be the right color. I think white is, white or gray is kind of the color right now that I'm feeling. During tomorrow and Wednesday, the sun is expected, but temperatures will be cold in the upper teens and going down to the single digits at night. On Thursday, temperatures are expected to get as high as 30 degrees, but the skies will be cloudy, and Friday there'll be a 50% chance of snow, along with blustery winds. Sounds like fun, right? Sun is predicted for next weekend, but temperatures will be remaining in the teens, so it's still winter. Yep. This is Local Talk. I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg. Stay tuned. We have good stuff coming. It is Monday, so here's a roundup of state news and Iowa in national news provided to you by the Iowa Informer, iowainformer.com. Governor Kim Reynolds signed a water quality bill into law last month, achieving a goal she set out in her Condition of the State address in January. It was her first bill as governor. The new law will allocate $282 million over 12 years from an existing water tax, as well as gambling revenues, and establish a water quality fund within the state's Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship for various agricultural conservation efforts. Reynolds called the bill's passage a, quote, monumental step forward, but critics were quick to point out the funding falls far short of the $4 billion an Iowa State University study found would be required to adequately address water pollution in Iowa. Environmentalists have long argued that mandatory regulations are necessary to improve Iowa's heavily polluted waterways, but regulations added in the new law are only voluntary measures instead of mandatory. Critics also say that measures are lacking to track its effectiveness. The former chairman of the Pottawatomie County Republican Party has formed a political action committee called Republicans for Conservative Values to support Iowa politicians who will back President Trump. The former chairman, Council Bluffs resident Jeff Jorgensen, told his hometown paper, the Daily Nonpareil, that he was, quote, forming this political action committee as a response to what Democrats have done, unquote, noting protests at recent events held by Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst. He added that the, quote, number one person on our hit list, unquote, would be Glenn Hurst, a Democrat running for the Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors, who is, quote, not somebody interested in advancing county governance, but advancing the liberal agenda, unquote. Jorgensen drew controversy last September when he promoted a conspiratorial anti-Islam presentation in Oakland, Iowa. Protesters at the event included Hurst. Agribusiness magnate and Republican Bruce Rastetter ended his controversial tenure as president of the Iowa Board of Regents at the end of April to refocus his attention on his private business ventures. On January 30th, Rastetter's Alden-based Summit Agricultural Group announced a $100 million expansion of FS Bioenergia, a corn ethanol plant in the Mato Grosso region of Brazil. The expansion is intended to increase the Mato Grosso plant's ethanol output from 60 million to 140 million gallons annually. Iowa made the international news over the weekend after a black man claimed on Facebook that he was racially profiled at an Old Navy in the Jordan Creek Mall in West Des Moines. The 29-year-old man, James Conley III, was wearing an Old Navy coat he'd received for Christmas, and a store manager demanded that he remove it so that it could be scanned to ensure it wasn't being stolen, something Conley said wasn't requested of other white customers. He said, every time I go into this store, I have on my same exact winter blue jacket and have never been asked to scan my clothing, and the previous non-black customer had an identical apparel on as me from Old Navy but was never asked to scan their clothing. He wrote this in a Facebook post that included videos of the incident. In response, Old Navy fired three employees at the Jordan Creek location and posted a message on Facebook that read in part, "The situation was a violation of our policies and values, and we apologize to both Mr. Conley and to those we've disappointed." Today, Iowa's political parties with major party status will hold precinct caucuses, the first step in a process that will lead to the formation of updated party platforms and, for the Democrats, potentially selecting delegates who will pick a gubernatorial candidate if, when the June 5th primary occurs, none in the crowded field receive 35% of the vote needed to win the nomination outright. The day will also be memorable for the state's Libertarian Party, which gained major party status last year after its presidential candidate, former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, received nearly double the votes needed to meet the required 2% threshold. It will be the first time in Iowa history that the Libertarian Party will hold a major party caucus. And that is some of state news and Iowa in national news provided by the Iowa Informer. You can find more news at iowainformer.com.
In the sand, making music in the grassy slough. Listen to the sound, universal roars, the wind pound against the shore. There's a flock coming down out of the sky, they're winnowing in the wind. Trees try to argue with the breeze, but you know they're gonna bend. Music in the wind. Music in the wind. Music in the wind.
Big Blue Sky. This is Local Talk on KHOI Radio. I'm your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. As you know, President Trump's recent comments about African countries and Haiti drew condemnation from around the world and cast doubts on hopes for resolving immigration legislation in the United States. Trump appeared to deny using the derogatory term that has now become infamous but cannot be quoted on the air here, according to FCC regulations, but he did acknowledge using, quote, tough language. Among Republicans, few condemned outright his remarks, and the lone Democrat present for the Oval Office encounter described the president's remarks as, quote, hate-filled, vile, and racist, unquote. Well, no matter what exactly was said, it's clear that Haiti and African countries have been cast in a negative light. But we're fortunate that in our community, we actually have many people living among us who are from those countries. We can actually go to people themselves and ask them to describe their countries and who they are as the immigrants who are coming from those countries. Today, we've been joined by Adamu Abraham, a Nigerian who lives and works here in central Iowa, and who has graciously allowed me to ask him some questions, not only about his country, but about his response to things that have been said recently. Adamu Ibrahim, you're from Nigeria.
I work in Ames for a clinic. I'm the telecommunication manager.
And you commute from Marshalltown.
Yes. My wife goes to Marshalltown Community College. She's trying to get into a nursing program. So I do the commute so she doesn't have to.
When the president made a derogatory statement of generalizing African countries, tell us what went through your mind as somebody who grew up in Nigeria.
Basically, I think if you know the countries that you're talking about, you wouldn't call them that, being the fact that your country engaged in a lot of relations with them. They didn't know the environment. For example, I've seen a lot of U.S. businesses. The U.S. have a huge embassy in two of the major cities in the country, an embassy and a consulate. And they are pretty busy.
The grain of truth is that many of these countries are not as well off as the United States.
Yes.
But you're also saying that These are countries that have relationships with the United States.
Nigeria is one of the oil-producing country, and I believe when all the refineries were firing, were working, the U.S. was one of the major consumers of Nigerian oil. I believe we have this huge embassies there. Maybe that's why there's a lot of U.S. businesses in the oil companies in Nigeria. And the U.S. also have a large population of either Nigerian students or international students living here.
When you say they're very busy, what do you mean?
A lot of people want to come to the U.S. for study so we can go back and better our community, our countries.
The derogatory reference to these countries was made in reference to people coming from those countries to the United States.
Most of us leave our country because we either come here to better ourselves. If the president knows what he's talking about, he won't call all these countries what he called them because international students pay a lot of money to be here, sometimes triple what U.S. citizens pay. I can only say this for my country, of course. Our government, in a year, they can say, oh, we want to sponsor 50 students to go to the U.S. to study. And these students, sometimes, they need 2 years to learn English. So they end up saying 6 years. So if you calculate that income to that university, sometimes it's small community colleges, small universities in small towns. Example, when I came here in 2009 to start Iowa Central Community College, that's where I graduated from, my government had a relationship with send some students to Iowa Central to learn. I don't know if there were 5 or 10 students, but if you can multiply that, you know, a government that's able to pay international fee for 10 students at a time to a community college, I think that's good income, if you look at it.
The comment President Trump made could be applied to you as someone who's emigrated from an African country. The derogatory reference in some ways does say that you are of lesser quality than a Northern European as an immigrant. What does that translate into you as somebody who actually is in that situation?
I usually listen to the radio when I drive from Marshalltown to work here in Ames. And when I heard that, it hurt a bit because, yes, I know I came to the U.S. to study because I wanted to learn what I can to take back to my country. And then I ended up staying here because I was hired to do a job. And I'm here. I'm still learning the trade, which eventually I plan to go back home and contribute to the technological development of my country. But as a father now, I had a son last year here in the U.S. It feels like, so if my son can hear this now, you know, and say, okay, how can he choose loyalty? Okay, because I was born in the U.S. This is my country, basically, to my son. But somebody, my president, is talking about this from where my dad comes from. Mm-hmm. So how do you inspire loyalty from your own citizens when you know that they can trace their route back to such countries? So right now you're creating your own enemies within, because how do you expect these kids to grow up and be patriotic to this country that doesn't respect their lineage? Like the saying goes, you know, we're all immigrants in this country. So if you don't respect that, how do you expect the growing people? One of the reasons people come to this country is because they believe in this country. The system works in this country. At least we believe it does. So it's because we trust in the U.S. system where you can better yourself because of the environment. The educational system is, of course, superior than ours. It's because of the advancement of technology. We believe this is where we can better ourselves so we can go better our community and our families. That's why we come here. Now, we might end up staying because, you know, we were convinced to stay, or we need more time to achieve our goals, and then we go back to our countries to do that.
Do you buy his portrayal of an immigrant from an African country as being inferior?
I don't. I'm not. Because if you are born in the U.S., you think it's easy to live in the U.S. It's not. So for us, an international student, you can't get a job off campus. You have to work on campus maximum 20 hours a week. And if you come to the U.S. from a country where people live on a dollar a day, and you have to struggle, you know, you have to be a full-time student. When we're coming, we don't know that you have to have insurance. If you have a car, you have to have insurance. You have to pay rent and all these things. Now, I'm fortunate because I had a U.S. family here since I was an exchange student. They helped me through a lot.
You were an exchange student as a high school student.
I came to the U.S. I did my exchange program in Nevada. Best time of my life.
What made it so good?
First of all, besides my host sister, I think I was the only black kid in the community, but I didn't feel different at all. You know, I was in soccer, in class, it was engaging all the teachers. I will say I was a little bit ahead because our curriculum is a little bit farther. Because, you know, all what we did in chemistry and physics, I've already taken some of them in Nigeria already because I was preparing for the national exam and stuff like that. So that part, I was good. But it was in speech and American government and other stuff. So there, sometimes the teachers spend more time with me, teaching me after class or before class. I go in early.
So they have winter in Nigeria?
No.
What's the weather like in Nigeria?
Well, it basically depends on the part of the country where you come from. I come from the north, and it's basically a desert. It's always 90 to sometimes 110 degrees, but it's dry heat. It's not humid like in Iowa.
So you discovered cold winters and humid summers?
I came in August. Nobody warned me about, you know, winter. And when October, November...
Nobody warned you about winter? You'd never heard of that?
No. Well, I see the movie, but I thought maybe it's just all, you know, sci-fi stuff. But actually, the first time it snowed, I came out of the house. I was about to get in the car, and my breath came out with, you know, the, I don't know if it's, what do you call it? Do you call it steam? So I ran in. And I told my mom that, I think my stomach is on fire.
If you just joined us, this is Local Talk. We are talking with Adamu Ibrahim, who works in Ames as a telecommunications manager and lives in Marshalltown with his family. He is from Sokoto in the Sokoto state of Nigeria. And he has graciously agreed to spend a little bit of time telling us about his home country. The community that you grew up in Nigeria. Give us a picture of what that community looked like.
Where I come from is really different. It's Sokoto State is it's actually the most peaceful state in the country because there haven't been any conflict in the past 200 years, and that's so it's known as the most peaceful state in the country. The reason why is because we see ourselves as a community. Everyone knows everybody, maybe 10 blocks away from them. The kids play all together, so there's this sense of community. We all do things together. If I'm building a house for my parents, I call all my friends. If you know how to do this part, you do it, and we lend you hand. So everything is sort of just like the Amish community here. Right? We do everything together, basically. That's one thing I miss about it sometimes, and
sounds like there's a feeling of safety and support there.
Yes. During the heat, when it's really hot, we all bring our mattress or maybe mats and sleep outside with our door wide open and nothing happens. That's why I fell in love with Iowa, because there's that sense of safety. So it's just like that in my community. You know.
Is this a small village or a town or a city? What?
It's a city. It's actually the capital of the state, Sokoto State. I live in the city. I would say it's about probably 1 million to 1.5 million people. It's a significant city. It's just that, you know, it's broken into streets. Everybody know almost everybody in that street because the kids go to school together. The parents usually work even in the same area, in either the same ministry or in the same school. So everybody, so our parents are friends, we are friends with the kids, and most Nigerians my age will agree with. Growing up as a kid, you know, we don't have toys. So we always go outside and play with bricks or sticks and stuff like that with other kids in the community. You know, we play in the street, of course, ones with less traffic. And in most yards have fences around them. So we usually just go to one person's house that have the most space. And then we all play, climb trees together, pluck on mango trees and, you know, or guava trees and stuff like that. Yeah. We play with the kids until it's time to eat, and then we go back home and eat and then come back and continue. Sometimes all do it till, you know, bedtime. At night, you know, the parents gather together with the kids and they tell us tales about things that happened before we were born or just folk tales, all this kind of stuff. And that's something I fear my son cannot do here.
It's the neighborhood.
Yeah, the neighborhood, you know, because, you know, here he's either always inside or just maybe take him to the playground where he can just play by himself. I feel my son is going to miss out of that. That's why we're thinking maybe when he gets to be 5 years old, we might have to send him home.
What did the house look like that you grew up in?
It was big. Basically, each family have a huge plot of land where everyone, when they decide to get married, they build their own section in the house. in the land. So it's kind of big.
So the extended family has different sections on the property?
Yes. Most Nigerians that you meet, they have a village. You had, if you live in the city, you have a village. So the city is usually for people that work or go to school. So work for the government or a factory. And the village is usually for farmers.
And are these large farms or small farms?
They are small.
And what is being grown on them?
In my state, it's primarily millet and beans, black-eyed peas, as you call it here. In the area where there's a little bit water, they grow rice as well, and sugar cane. That's only in the rainy season, though, which I believe May through August.
And do you have wealth and poverty?
Yes, it's usually very poor or rich. Mm-hmm. So there is no middle. And the poor is usually the farmers, and they just grow their food and feed themselves and the family and then sell fuel so they can get by. And the rich ones are usually the businessmen, and the really rich ones are also the corrupt government officials that loot all the resources that are supposed to go to all the people.
Can you describe the food a little bit?
We eat a lot of grain, rice. I don't feel okay if I don't eat white rice. And we have a traditional meal made out of rice. So it's basically a mashed rice with a vegetable soup. It's made with maybe spinach and meat, fish, or any other ingredient.
How do people entertain themselves?
That's a very good question. My community is predominantly Muslim. We're a bit conservative. My state is very serious. So it's really hard to have fun. So usually young people is only soccer or movies, which is at home because there is no cinema. There is no movie theater at all.
So it's a very religious community.
It's a very, yes.
And you're practicing Muslim?
Yes, I am. When I left, there is this huge barrier between male and female. It's beginning to change now because even in the college now, people sit together. The teachers are from the community. They know our culture. It's all changed, you know, the advent of social media and the all these international NGOs that are coming in are changing people's perception.
When you came back to the United States as a college student, what was your goal?
When I came to the U.S., I fell in love with technology. So when I went back home, I went and majored in mass communication, and I was volunteering at an HIV/AIDS clinic.
Now, this is in Nigeria?
This is in my state, Sokoto State in Nigeria. And my job there was to gather the medical record of people living with HIV/AIDS. Now, all these are not filed electronically. It's just somebody's name alphabetically, sometimes maybe their first name, sometimes their last name, depending on who is opening the file for them that day. So I was doing some research. I was like, this can't be a better way to organize this. And I was talking to my host mom, who is now deceased. And she told me, oh, there's something called electronic medical record. You guys don't have it there. I was like, oh, what is that? So she told me, and I did some research. Unfortunately, there is no university or college in Nigeria that offers that. Mm-hmm. So she encouraged me to come to the U.S. and study for that. And, you know, she said you have to start with computers, of course, which I know nothing about then. So my intention was to come to the U.S., learn a lot about computers, and possibly learn about this electronic medical record so I can take it back home and introduce it, because it can also give data to the government. So when I came here, I studied computer networking at Iowa Central Community College. During my downtime, I was doing some research on it, and I found some open source medical record system that me and my friend, we customized the application, and in 2013, we were ready. We took it to the government, and we took it to the Commissioner of Health, who basically is in charge of the health ministry.
Now, this is in Nigeria.
Yes, this is in my state, in Sokoto State, Nigeria, to donate this and offer our, you know, expertise. And he wasn't interested in this application. He was only interested in how much he was going to make. So that got shut down. So, you know, we just shelved it, and we came back and never got that to happen. So now my plan is, well, you know, I will work here, you know, and eventually save up with my retirement when I retire and go start up. And maybe if these foreign organizations, maybe World Health Organization, they want this data, they can invest in such tools.
It sounds like you still have the dream to bring this kind of data processing to government hospitals in Nigeria, but it's a dream deferred.
Yes.
So you're really a citizen of the world now, and you're kind of waiting for your time to come to bring this vision to Nigeria.
Yes, I'm learning something little by little. And, mm-hmm. you know, I can't translate it exactly into my own community, but, you know, I can take some part of it and domesticate it. So my dream is still there, but, you know, I'm just saving up for time and resources.
You gained these skills in the United States, and you wanted to apply them to the medical system in Nigeria, and you found that they were not receptive to that. What kind of a conclusion do you draw about Nigeria right now?
Well, I'm going to start from the top. So the current administration, they're doing all they can to fight corruption because that's a major problem in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. The leaders are very corrupt. There's enough oil money to make Nigeria a very rich state where every citizen can live comfortably. But, you know, it only stops at the top, you know, they skim off everything, they take everything. So
you're frustrated with your government.
I am. Mm-hmm. I am frustrated. I think they need to focus their priority on doing things that will create jobs. Nigerians are very creative. We can create jobs if we have the means. Mm-hmm. But then without power, how can people do other stuff? We spend billions of naira, millions of dollars, sending people abroad to go to school. A few years back, the government sponsored 50 students to go to Bulgaria to study medicine. Fine and good. They all graduated, did very well. But few of them came back. There is no tools in the hospital for what they've learned. So most of them, I think last time I checked, only a few of them came back. The rest of them went back to Bulgaria and got mm-hmm. good jobs and stayed there. Mm-hmm. So you use our resources to basically build Bulgaria.
The president was remarking about countries that are not as maybe as well organized or that have problems in Africa, and somehow saying that reflects on the people who are coming from that country. But the people actually are a huge asset, in a way, is what you're saying, right?
Yes, right. Again, I can only speak for Nigeria, like I said, but most Nigerians, we are hardworking. There's bound to be some that are bad. But the majority, you know, we are hardworking because we know what it takes to come here. And most of us, even though we come here and stay, our condition might have changed for not going back. Most of us want to go home. But you don't want to go home, leave your family here, and just wake up and hear, oh, by the way, Nigeria mm-hmm. is added to the band, you know, the list of countries that can't come in.
The travel ban is something that worries you?
Yes, you never know with the president. You never know. I mean, mm-hmm. I haven't been home. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go last year and this year, but I'm a bit worried.
But you didn't go?
I didn't go because, you know. So, you know, that's one thing that scares a lot of Nigerians. I don't want to go home now because mm-hmm. something major can happen on your way back and you get stranded and you have families and ties here in the U.S. Before we came here, I mean, I think the exchange program that the U.S. State Department is doing have changed American perception on a lot of African countries, a lot of Muslim countries, because mm-hmm. what you see in the media, the way you guys, people see media here portraying Africa as bad or as poor or other stuff, it's the same thing our media do back home. They will be saying all this stuff that the president of the U.S., is saying your country is this.
You're saying that the media in Nigeria picks up the messages that the United States president says
yes.
and uses that locally?
Yes.
So if the American president says our African countries are no good, that's taken as fact?
That's taken as fact. That's why he's creating a lot of hard work for his embassies, because now whenever they go and meet governors or other people, they have to explain that. I mean, before, most community in Nigeria have a preconceived idea of what U.S. is like. You know, we see violence in the movies, we see everything, we think it's like that. It's left for people like us that come to the U.S. and then we go back home and say, oh, that's not true, because that's not how we are. Most people, they expect us when we go back home to be dressed with chains and everything and have guns and stuff. So we go there and we change this perception. Now, if we don't get to go back home and explain all this stuff, people take what they hear in the media that, okay, mm-hmm. this is what it is. So I think the U.S. embassy now have a lot of work cut out for them.
When this happened recently, Did it affect at all how people treated you here?
No, it didn't. I get confused sometimes when I hear what the president say or what I hear in the media, because I have been in the U.S. for, say, 10 years. I have never faced any problem with anybody. I have never been treated differently. Everywhere I've gone, I've been respected. That's why I get confused when I hear this kind of say, okay, the leader is acting this way and the people are acting this way. So I know there's a lot of, you know, all this political debates going on about immigrants and stuff. But me, myself, and most of my family members and friends that I've spoken, most people would love their country to be seen as America. Most people would love people to want to come to their country in search for better life. I mean, sometimes when we were in Nigeria, we're like, why don't Nigeria have a green card or a path to citizenship? And mm-hmm. I was like, well, because nobody wants to come. The U.S., there is something that we hope will never change, is if you're hardworking and honest, you always make it in the U.S. because the system works. There is something that we are always praying that it doesn't matter who is the president, it doesn't matter who is the leader, we always know that the American people will always appreciate you. If you are hardworking, you know what you're doing, and you're honest, you always live okay, you always get a job. And I think Americans should be honored and proud that, you know, their country is where people seek to come and better their life or gain experience. If they end up staying, they are contributing to the economy or to the society. So I think the system is working. It's mm-hmm. just in a high-level view, maybe somebody's not seeing that. People that are here, mm-hmm. you know, they came here in search of a better life. We bring a different perspective of thinking. Also, we contribute in the community because, trust me, if you were not you, you wouldn't be here.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We have been speaking with Adamu Ibrahim, who is a resident of Central Iowa. He works in Ames and lives in Marshalltown with his family. He is from Sokoto, Nigeria, and graciously agreed to come and speak with us about his home country and to share his perspective on recent events and comments made about African countries. And my apologies to Mr. Ibrahim. I have a feeling that the drumming that we're listening to is not typical of his area in Nigeria. I forgot to ask him for a suggestion for music. So, again, this is Nigerian drumming, but I have a feeling it is not from Sokoto. It's January 5th, the first Monday of the month, and that means that City Councilwoman Bronwyn Beatty-Hansen is here for her monthly report on what's happening at the Ames City Council, and Dennis Hart is here as usual to discuss it with her.
Let's begin with what's coming up immediately tonight, Monday night. City Council, other stakeholders going to meet at the library to get the results of a consulting firm study on that proposed Healthy Life Center. What do you expect and hope to hear tonight?
I am excited for this meeting. We've been talking about the Healthy Life Center for a while now, and I think what I want to see most is a plan of action with steps we can take to really get this thing moving if we're going to. It seems like it's been kind of conceptual at this, you know, up to this point, until we hired the consultant, you know, really get down into the nitty-gritty of what the costs will be. And so I'm excited to see how now we can move forward with plan to raise funds and site select and things like that.
What exactly would a Healthy Life Center include that would benefit the community? Explain exactly what that means, a Healthy Life Center.
The concept is really about, I suppose it would be like, in a sense, a fitness center, but the goal with this Healthy Life Center is that it would be multi-generational, and so it would have fitness activities for all different populations. You'd have kids being able to exercise there. Adults, also elderly, would have activities there. One of the partners in this venture is Heartland Senior Services, and they provide a lot of services to the community that we could house out there, too. But in addition to fitness, you know, other things that are related to health. So maybe like a teaching kitchen where we could have classes on nutrition and cooking that people in the community could attend. And I think those sorts of things are really beneficial, too, as we're looking at healthy lifestyles in in the broad sense.
Earlier, Parks and Recs director Keith Abraham estimated it could cost $50 million. Where could that money potentially come from? That's a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, it is. And I think there, you know, there are a number of sources, and we'll probably, to be successful, I think we'd have to hit them all. You know, we'd be definitely looking to raise money from private donations, and, you know, I'm sure there'd be maybe potentially naming rights, things like that. There's that. Probably part of it is going to require a public bond referendum. Then also, you know, other funding, normal sources of funding to Parks and Rec, some prior gift money they have, I think, and then other partners to see what they might be able to bring to the table, too. You know, we have a lot of partners in this venture, and hopefully they're all have an idea for sources of cash as well. We'd have to have the bond vote, obviously, and that it would have to be successful before we'd be able to move forward with the project. But I do hope to see that we'll have a time frame that's reasonable and not too far out in the future. 2 years, something like that. Public input has really been important through this whole process.
Speaking of money, you and other city council members have several meetings this week about the budget.
Big budget items are typically what you'd expect. I mean, we spend a lot on streets and roads, and we spend a lot on public safety, you know, as we rightfully should as a community. But I suppose in that streets and roads category, I'm really excited to get on with the extension of Grand Avenue to the south. That's a really important stretch of road. We really need to connect that up, and so that is in the next few years in our CIP, and that's really exciting.
Saturday's Tribune reported that could be a 31% tax decrease per $1,000 of assessed valuation to help offset property tax valuation increases. Now, for the average person reading that, they're saying, what in the world is this all about? Can you explain it in layman's language how this might work?
A lot of folks noticed that the valuation on their house went up this year. So, now, for some folks it didn't, but in general, residential valuations went up quite a bit. And so if we keep the tax rate the same and your valuation has gone up, you're going to get a fairly substantial increase in taxes. So what, you know, what we try to do is run a tight ship in the city, and I think the departments do a really great job of that. And so we are actually able to bring down our tax rate just a little. But because of the increased valuations, we still bring in the same amount of money and a little bit more, in fact, in order to pay for the same level of services. So what you see is the tax rate coming down, your house's value going up, and the two of those sort of equalizing so that you're not paying too much more, actually. It keeps it really steady, which is nice compared to if we had to keep the rate the same to where it is now, you'd see a bigger increase. It sounds like the states still say they're committed to the promise of giving cities about $1 million backfill tax money. If they don't, then we need to look at either sources for another $1 million to pay for city services, or we need to look at what services could be pared down, neither of which are a great situation to be in, so we hope we don't have to do that.
One of the looming issues for the council is what to do with the old Ames Middle School site on State Avenue. Recently, council and JCOR decided against proceeding with a development proposal. What prompted that to fall apart?
What really caused us to pause there and essentially go back to the drawing board was that in order to meet the requirements for the CDBG funding, the affordable lots would have to be developed and sold prior to market rate lots being developed and sold. And so I think there was some concern that if they couldn't find a big enough pool of buyers for the affordable lots, that JCORP might be stuck in this project for longer than they might like to be. And so they were asking for a buyout plan, basically, that would give them some period of time, say 3 years or so. And if buyers weren't being found for the affordable housing, then JCORP would have some way for the city to buy them out of their investment in the project. I think we just felt like that was too much of an unknown and too much of a financial risk considering how much we've already put into that project in terms of the land value and infrastructure improvements. So right now, council has directed staff to go ahead and plan to improve the infrastructure on the site by putting Trip Street through, which is a good way for us to be able to spend down the funds from the CDBG funds. We need to spend those down in a timely manner or we don't get them. And so in order to meet our timeliness test, putting Trip Street through is a good way to use those funds on that property. And then I think the idea is then to start the process of looking for folks who might be eligible for affordable housing in that project, and then also start developing some lots just a few at a time. So we at least get the ball rolling, we're putting money into the site, and we see development there over time. And that's kind of where we're headed at the moment.
Now, as you well know, the Neighborhood Association there very much wants single-family homes.
On this one, I really can see it both ways. I mean, they fought long and hard, the neighborhood did, in order to prevent high-density student housing from being developed on the site, and they deserve a lot of credit, I think, for mobilizing the community and making sure that that land was protected, basically, and used for lower-density, more family-oriented housing. And that's a good thing, I think. There's a lot of different sources of funding that you can leverage when you start to allow rental. So that was, I think, what council is considering on the flip side. Part of what killed the project the first time here is funding, you know, just the fact that financially it's tricky to build affordable housing. You know, new construction is expensive and you have to find ways to subsidize that. And so with more funding sources that you might get through rental housing, that opens up LIHTC credits, which is like a low-income tax credit, that leverages a lot of funding. But again, I'm torn on that one. I think the neighbors have fought long and hard to keep it where it is, and so I do feel an obligation to a certain extent to listen to them and to protect their neighborhood. You know, they're worried about the stability of their neighborhood in general. They want to see more owner-occupied properties, more properties. You know, I want to see more properties with kids in the school district, you know, so I understand too that owner-occupied does do a lot for the stability of a neighborhood.
Why are more multifamily needed, especially in this neighborhood, in this particular neighborhood?
The argument for that, I suppose, would be that a lot of folks who are lower income might not be able to afford actually buying a house. And so there is some room, certainly in our community, for affordable housing that's rental styled. And also you can get people who have even lower incomes in a stable living environment where they're just renting, whereas they're not going to be stable in an owner-occupied model. And so there's that to be said just for the need for affordable rental housing in general.
It's a tough call. Mm-hmm. And you don't have easy decisions on the horizon on this one.
I know. Yeah, and it's interesting. I looked back in my calendar at meetings I was having a year ago, and here, almost a year to the day, I was meeting with the neighborhood folks to discuss this very project, and here we are back a year later talking about the same thing, and I really hope we can make some progress, and I don't look back in 2019 in January and see the same thing happening again. That's my goal.
Let's briefly talk, since we're talking multifamily homes, let's talk about the new rental ordinance that the council gave its final approval to since the last time you and I have talked. It's in effect now, after a long period of discussion. Very briefly, what does the new ordinance say? What are the new rules involving rental occupancy?
Currently, the new ordinance says that if you have three bedrooms or less, you can have up to three people in those rental units. If you have a fourth or fifth bedroom, you can have a fourth or fifth tenant if you've got the parking for it, basically. We are having a workshop that I would love to draw folks' attention to. It's a workshop on topics related to the rental housing occupancy issues. And that is on February 20th. And I would definitely invite folks who have a stake in that, you know, whether who are renting or if they're landlords or you name it, because we'll be discussing both the occupancy limits that we've looked at so far and things like that. But I think also we'll be looking at the concept of overlays, where we might permanently limit the number of rental properties in a geographic area. And that's just a concept at this point, but that's one that I think would be significant and people should keep an eye on.
few days ago, city council members went to the Iowa State campus to talk about this never-ending issue of pedestrian traffic on Lincoln Way. What exactly came from this meeting?
The joint meeting with student government. That was a really interesting meeting. They've formed a committee there, a pedestrian safety committee formed of students to look at the topic of crossing, especially from the Buchanan area right across Lincoln Way. The city has our pedestrian safety study. It's coming into phase two here where we'll actually get some recommendations for design and signage elements that can help calm traffic and help ease crossings. In addition to pedestrian safety, we talked about bicycling quite a bit, making that easier and safer in Ames. So the city has its complete streets policy it's working on to do that very thing, and you could tell that's also important to students.
One of the things that have been talked about for a lot of years is the idea of a pedestrian overpass on Lincoln Way, but Councilman Betcher said that's probably not really practical. Explain why that. Is that a matter of money?
I think it's money and use. So they are very, very expensive, for one thing. But then studies just show that they're not super utilized. I mean, imagine you have to take stairs for one thing. And so you have a bunch of ADA issues as well. You know, it doesn't make crossing easier for someone in a wheelchair to have to go up and over a bridge and back down, or it doesn't make crossing easier for an elderly person, or you name it. You know, there are a lot of ADA issues with a pedestrian bridge. So I think they're useful in circumstances where you need to, like, cross a freeway or something. But I don't know that Lincoln Way is quite at that level where a pedestrian bridge would give us more benefit than it would have drawbacks.
To be realistic, one of the issues is that students simply cross against the rules. I mean, a lot of people do it in all parts of every city, but in this particular street, in this particular camp, a lot of students are crossing the street against lights and in between. How can you realistically enforce something like that or stop that behavior? How do you do that?
Oh, good question. It's sort of a cultural behavior in a sense. And so I think you have to sort of change that culture. And I think the way to best effectively do that is through their peers. You know, I think students have to be the ones who take that message to each other. And so hopefully that this pedestrian safety committee and sort of the efforts they're taking on will help do that. The police of Ames have our walk, drive, bike, smart campaign. So we advocate respect between all users and, you know, following the traffic signals and things like that, too, which is a great message, but there's only so far that'll go. I mean, I think students need to listen to other students.
Let's briefly talk about something you just brought up, and we've discussed it before, but not everybody listens to us when we're on every month or, you know, people miss conversations. The Complete Streets Plan that you brought up. That study's going on. What would that entail for the community?
Really, right now, we have a consultant working on designing what that policy will look like. And what we'll get ends up looking like a toolkit that you use when you're designing a street or looking at the traffic systems, finding routes and maximizing routes for all users. I don't mean to say that there's a bike path on every street, but just that bikers as a group have good east-west connections across town, they have good north-south connections across town that are safe and connected and well-signed, people know how to use. It doesn't mean that every single east-west road has to have one such connection, but just when we're looking at our transportation systems in general, that we have those good pedestrian routes, good bike routes, good bus routes, that sort of thing. You know, obviously, there are roads that are not suited for certain types of transportation. I'm never really going to advocate for putting a bike lane on South Duff. There are good ways to run parallel routes, so you want to watch for those, you know, maybe an off-street bike path or just another north-south route that runs sort of parallel and has some good connections to businesses on Duff. And there's also tiny residential streets that are never going to be a bus route, but we want to maximize our bus routes across town, make sure we have good connectivity. And I think that's what Complete Streets is all about, a toolkit that we use to design roads and ensure that.
Well, we've talked about everything from money to pedestrian safety on Lincoln Way to Ames Middle School.
All right. Well, thank you.
It is a pleasure talking with you as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bronwyn Beatty Hansen, Ames City Councilwoman at Large, and Dennis Hart, KHOI Civic Reporter. Thank you to both for filing this monthly report. This is Local Talk. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Let's end our time together by turning our gaze back out the window to the sentient beings living out in the winter landscape, in this case, the saw-whet owl in particular. Here's Pat Schlarbaum, KHOI's environmental reporter.
Phenology is recording nature's happenings when they occur. the first snowy owl of winter or the last marsh hawk of autumn are recorded in a journal for future reference. Today's phonology is about the little saw-wet owls. A delightful small bird about the size of an American robin with great big eyes comes to Iowa each winter. Saw-wet owls are with us once again. Birders who prowl through evergreen groves in winter sometimes find this round-headed little gnome perched there, sitting still, as if to avoid notice. Avoiding notice is a task at which this owl often succeeds. It is overlooked in many places where it occurs. Their high-pitched toot-toot-toot call, rhythmically tooting song, is a common evening sound in the Boundary Waters evergreen forests from April to June, where they nest. The owl was named for this song, which reminded settlers of the sound of a whetstone sharpening a saw wet. It's a tiny owl with a cat-like face, oversized head, and bright yellow eyes. The northern saw-wet owl is practically bursting with attitude. Where mice and other small mammals are concerned, this fierce, silent owl is anything but cute. One of the most common owls in northern forests across northern North America and across the U.S. in winter, saw-wets are highly nocturnal and seldom seen. Northern saw-wet owls have a reddish-brown body with the white streaks on the belly. Their neck is speckled with white. The speckles and stripes in the feathers of the saw-wet helps to camouflage them when they are roosting and hunting. Young saw-wet owls are chocolate brown with white spots above their bills and over their eyes. The plumage coloration of the juvenile and adult saw-wet owls is so vastly different that if you are unfamiliar with the species, you would think there were two different types of owls. Many saw-wets migrating to Iowa are juveniles or young of the year. Owls have digestive properties that grinds away bones and hair, creating a tidy pellet that is expelled through their gizzard and mouth. Where saw-wet are perching during the day, a pellet is often left behind. Many young budding biologists will dissect the furry pellets to learn what rodents the owl was living on. The pellets are a biologic diary of undigested bones of their prey. Saw-wet owls usually eat adult mice in pieces over the course of two meals, and they will cache extra food. They may kill as many as six mice, one after the other, without consuming any of them during the time of the hunt. In the winter, the cached prey may freeze. When the cached prey is retrieved, it will be carried to a roosting area where the owl will then thaw the prey by lying on it in the same manner as they incubate eggs. When a saw-wet feels threatened, it will elongate its body, often bringing one wing around to the front of its body to hide its legs and feet. It is believed this is to help camouflage the owl by causing it to appear more like a tree branch. Migration in saw-wets has historically been poorly understood because of their nocturnal, reclusive behavior. In the 1990s, researchers began Project OwlNet, a collaboration that now consists of more than 100 owl migration banding sites. Researchers used the toot-toot-toot call to lure owls into mist nets and band thousands of saw-wets every fall. Conservationist Jerry Toll near Omaha and Don Pogensey of Ida Grove, west of here, are active saw-wet banders in Iowa. Researchers have learned the oldest saw-wet was at least 9 years. So keep the little saw-wets in mind in your walks through grassy and natural areas with a smattering of evergreen trees like the Ledges and McFarland Park. You might just see a delightful little owl. It's been said they're as cute as a bug's ear. They're just so darn cute. And that's our phonology of saw-wet owls that are visiting North America this time of year. This is Pat Schlarbaum with KHOI Community Radio, 89.1, Story City, Ames.
Thank you, Patch Larbaum. And that's it for Local Talk. I've been your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Earlier in the show, we heard from Adamu Ibrahim and Bronwyn Beatty Hansen with Dennis Hart. We also heard a roundup of state news and Iowa in the national news from this past week from iowainformer.com. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI. Also remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to guests and information you heard during the show. KHOI is streaming live at khoifm.org. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join us. Stay tuned for headline news and Democracy Now! At 8 a.m. and Morning Masterpieces at 9 a.m. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI absolutely meaningful and absolutely possible. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting Iphigenia, a new telling of an old legend about the daughter of Agamemnon, February 23rd through March 4th in Ames. Tickets and showtimes at theater.iastate.edu.